Greetings and welcome to the 24th edition of Dinosaurs, Science, and the Bible with religion professor Dr. John Ney. Dr. John, what are we going to be talking about today?
Well, Dave, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. And last week, if you were able to join us, we dealt with the flood being global or local from a biblical perspective. And then we went into what God has put all around us in support of the inspiration of His Word, knowing that sometimes we doubts creep in sometimes to our view of Scripture. We have a saying, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it for me. Well, hopefully it does, that your faith is that strong. But there are times that that we doubt. We are inundated in our culture with the philosophy of evolution. And that philosophy has permeated virtually every aspect of our culture, secular education. You can hardly turn on any type of a science program on television and not be confronted with a philosophy of evolution. So when we look from a biblical perspective at the flood, as to whether it was a local flood or a global flood, I would pray that that you're convinced from the program last week and the week preceding that from a biblical perspective, the flood of Genesis, the flood of Noah, was a global flood, a flood of over one solar year in duration. Well, God knew that this philosophy of evolution would eventually permeate our culture, and He has given us so much extant or extrinsic or outside of the Bible to support the fact that the Bible is the inspired Word of God. And last week we began with one of the tremendous proofs or evidences, if you will, that the flood of Noah was factual and was global, and that was coal. We talked a little bit about coal and found all over planet Earth up to an estimated 14 trillion tons of coal. And the amount of plant foliage it would take to do that, just a little bit. The basic, real simplistic equation is 7 cubic foot of plant foliage to form 1 cubic foot of coal, realizing that coal is different hardnesses. I mentioned last week, and I mentioned again this week, in case you weren't able to be with us, that I lived in Nebraska for a while, myself and my wife, and we lived about a mile and a half from a railroad track in Nebraska, where every 15 minutes at night a coal train came by. The coal trains that ran that particular line, we're talking 115 cars. Most coal trains, 100 to 115 cars. Each car held approximately 4,400 cubic foot of coal. And here's the shocking, to me shocking part, that had been taking place for 28 years. Now that's just coal coming on this one particular line out of Wyoming through Nebraska. Coal is being excavated on a global scale at a mind-boggling amount. Well, coal comes from foliage, and which supposedly is transitioned into peat, and then from peat ultimately into three different hardnesses of coal. Well, this coal, again, is found all over the Earth, including the Arctic and Antarctica. And within the coal seams themselves that were made up of plant foliage, we find foliage of tremendous size relative to the foliage of like plants today. Fern leaves, 6 to 8 foot in length, preserved, coalified, so that the very print as a cast would, and we're talking about fossilization, attesting to temperate climate foliage. And again, that goes back to our second day of the creation week and the water vapor canopy and a relatively uniform temperature on planet Earth, conducive to longevity of life, conducive to tremendous health for all organics. So I don't want to go through all of that. I get drawn back in to go through everything we talked about last week. But we left off mentioning that where is coal being formed at any amount worth mentioning today? And the bottom line is, nowhere that man knows. The dismal swamp of West Virginia is pointed to as a place where coal is forming today. Well, there's an estimated 7-foot seam of peat. Now, peat is not coal. Peat is to be transitional from the foliage to coal, but peat is not coal. But anyway, this is pointed to along with several other places, and we're talking 3-foot seams, 4-foot seams, and when I say several, I'm talking less than a dozen, at least from what I can find on the internet, where coal is being formed today. Yet we have this enormous, mind-boggling estimate of coal on planet Earth today. Where did it all come from? The flood of Genesis, the flood of Noah. We're talking a land-to-water ratio before the flood, probably about opposite of today. The lithosphere of the Earth, the crust of the Earth, makes up approximately 30% to 35% of Earth's surface. The rest is water. We're talking 70% to 75% water, and that's on the surface. That's not counting the water within the crust of the Earth, the lithosphere, and that's estimated to be 6% from the research that I've done. So all of this coal. It's just like God saying, hey, in case you doubt just a little bit, here's all this coal. And not only is it going to strengthen your faith and my word is being inspired, you can use it as a fossil fuel. Now, last week, again, that's about where we got. And I have here in my hand, and of course, those of you listening this morning can't see this, but I have a model of a chunk of coal that was excavated from a coal mine in Willerton coal mine in Thomas, Oklahoma, 1912. And the man involved with this particular chunk of coal, a man by the name of Frank Kennard, and he, at this particular time, was working in the municipal electric plant there in Thomas, Oklahoma. Again, this is 1912. Now, I'm reading a letter that's been notarized from him and to the Creation Evidences Museum in Glen Rose, Texas, where not the model, but the actual artifact is located at this time. And here's how his letter reads. While I was working in the municipal electric plant in Thomas, Oklahoma, 1912, I came upon a solid chunk of coal which was too large to use. I broke it with a sledgehammer. This iron pot fell from the center, leaving the impression or mold of the pot in a piece of coal. Jim Stoll, an employee of the company, witnessed the breaking of the coal and saw the pot fall out. I traced the source of the coal and found that it came from Wilburton, the Wilburton, Oklahoma mines. Signed, Frank Kennard, and sworn before me this date. It's a notarized letter. So I have this model here in front of me. Now, what might be profound about this? Well, the window of time for the formation of coal, I think most everything would fit in this particular window. We're talking 250 to 350 million years ago. And of course, the millions of years is nothing shocking to our culture. But it's interesting that within this chunk of coal, there was found an iron pot. And I have the model here. Look at there, Dave. And that's pretty clear. And this was made from a cast from the actual artifact. And what's an iron pot doing in a chunk of coal 250 to 350 million years of age when man only goes back far less than 500,000 years of age?
I'm thinking that hundreds of millions of years is a fantasy. What about you, John?
Well, I think you know where I stand on that, Dave. Absolutely. But it's a fantasy that has been embraced by our culture. And it sounds, you know, you're listening this morning, you say, this is absolutely insane to think of an Earth being, as some of you know, well, I propose 6,000 or so years of age. Well, how do we know? You know, how do we determine what is or isn't true? We're talking about the flood here, of course, in the last several sessions and a couple more to follow. Well, you know, when you take a physical object and you're given a story for what you see, if the story for what you're seeing seems to make sense to you, it's presented in a credible way, you consider the source of the information to be a credible source of information, it matches with your personal paradigm, your personal worldview, chances are you're going to accept it as true. Well, as you look around the Earth, we find this tremendous amount of sedimentary deposition, strata layers, water laid down layers, if you will, on a global scale and of a depth up to 1 mile in depth. So you look at something like the Grand Canyon and you see the stratification layers and you say, you know, this just took millions and millions and millions of years. For example, it was believed by many geologists, and not so many today, that the Grand Canyon was formed by the Colorado River. Well, if you were to come along and you're going to put a stake down the riverbed here, and then you put another one 100 yards away, another one 100 yards away, and you came back in 10 years, and you found out that the overall erosion of the Colorado riverbed was 1/64th of an inch. That was the average. Wow, let me see. It took 10 years to erode this riverbed 1/64th of an inch. Well, now you go to the canyon wall, a 1/64th of an inch for 10 years. Let me see. 1 inch, that's 640 years. So you begin to go up this canyon wall every inch 640 years. Well, by the time you get to the top, talking up to a mile, you're going to determine this is very, very, very old. Now the concept that is being applied in my illustration is the concept of uniformitarianism. Everything goes on now as the same now as it's always gone on. So this river gradually, over millions and millions of years, cut down to where it is today. And you see this, you look at it, it's on the Discovery Channel for illustration purposes now. Many geologists do not believe this anymore, but this was at one time the predominant story for what is seen. So you see this on the Discovery Channel, it's in National Geographic magazine, there are pictures, it's in your school book. Well, most people, it must be, matter of fact, if Dan Rather said it, it must be true, okay? But they embrace this as true. Now, you can take the same physical object for illustration purposes here, the Grand Canyon, and is there another story for what we see? A story that makes as much, if not more, sense. And the proposal is, yes, there is another story for what we see. Proverbs 18, verse 17 says, any story sounds true until someone tells the other side. And we can think of times that's happened in our lives. But at any rate, the other story is, this took place in a very, very short time period. And the stratification took place in a very, very short time period. And the stratification, of course, would ultimately include coal and where the coal seams are found. So you have the same physical object, but two different stories for what you see. I remember when I taught at the college, I would ask the students that took our two-credit hour course on creation science to find a pickle jar. And this is right at the first week of the course. And take this pickle jar, and I want you to put some gravel in it. I want you to put some clay in it. I want you to put some sand in it. I want you to find some chicken bones, or if you're really tired of your pet parakeet and that, get some bones somewhere, throw them in here. Shake this thing up, and I want you to let it set until midterms. And then at midterms, I'd have them come in, and we'd take a look at what had happened. Well, we had stratification. We have sedimentary deposition. We had water that actually sorted what was in it. You know, the heavier things went to the bottom, and you had this stratification layer. Then you have the next heavier or next dense. It went down next. You have this next stratification layer, and it would stratify very, very neatly. And since this all took place in a short time and there weren't millions of years between the layers, there was no erosion of the bottom layer. You know, you look at the Grand Canyon. I need to get back to my subject here. And you look at the Grand Canyon and you see these layers. Well, nice, neat line going across here, okay? When really, if this particular layer had been there for millions of years before the other layer built upon it, there should be all kinds of erosion, and it should not be a uniform line. We're talking the climatic conditions. We're talking rivers and storms, et cetera. But instead, you see this nice, neat layering. So the point I'm wanting to make, of course, is a person can look at a physical object, and you're given a story for what you see, and it seems to make sense, and it comes from a source you consider to be credible, most accepted as true. And then you have another story which is excluded and not presented, and sometimes when it is presented, it's misrepresented by secular education or by the media, and then what's a person going to end up finally believing? And that's where, you know, we that are Christians and view the Bible as inspired, God has given us this measuring device, this canon, this standard, to go and measure what we see in the world around us and what we're being taught, to see if it's true or not true. And God didn't leave us in this conundrum or dilemma of trying to determine what is or isn't true. So anyway, coal, what a tremendous evidence God has given us that there was, as 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5 and following tells us, the world before the flood, the world at that time was deluged and destroyed, flooded. And but the present heavens are being reserved for fire. So we look around us, we see this coal, we say, you know, what the Bible has to say about the world before the flood and things that Noah had not seen, Hebrews 11, verse 7, you know, I think that is definitely true. Where did all this coal come from anyway? Now, I mentioned the water-to-land ratio, by the way, before the flood, that Pangaea or Gaia, the single continent, was probably the opposite of the land-to-water ratio that we have today. And if we're talking temperate climate, we're talking an astronomical amount of foliage, mind-boggling amount. Where did all that go? It's in the coal seams today. So at that point, I want to move to another one here, Dave. I'm not giving you much a chance to share. I know I tend to do that. Just the 7 a.m. classes, I look at my students just kind of falling off to the side. They're out of those chairs. But I just have so much to share here. Well, the next area that I want to mention a little bit that, again, just a tremendous empirical evidence of the flood of the book of Genesis, Noah's flood, is I want to begin with verse 20 of Genesis chapter 7. If you have your Bible, turn with me this morning over to Genesis chapter 7, beginning in verse 20. And verse 20 says this, "The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of 20 feet. I'm reading from the NIV in this particular case. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished, birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. Men and animals and the creatures that move along the ground and the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left and those with him in the ark. The waters flooded the earth for 150 days. Now, if that is true, and we are talking from the creation account, man in particular on day six to the point of the flood. You can do this very easily in your own, in your Bible. You'll come up with 1,656 years. Now, whether we're talking solar years or lunar years or one of the other four or five different calendars, the bottom line is we're talking a long time. So we're talking about a lot of people, and we're talking about a lot of animals. You know, what should we find in the world around us today, in the post-diluvian time, if you will, the time after the flood, and that would attest to a death of a magnitude that would just boggle the mind of living creatures? You know, as we look around us, we should find this sediment of this total upheaval of this continent and the breaking up of this continent and the drowning of those things that couldn't swim for close to a solar year or so. We should find fossils all over Earth at all different elevations that would vividly attest to the factuality of the flood. And of course, that's exactly what is found. About 1/7 of the Earth's surface from Siberia into Alaska is a frozen muck containing the remains of millions of mammoths. Now, Russia exported ivory for many, many years, and I don't know if they still do or not. Many of the, I found this interesting, many of the really fine quality sets of billiard balls, the balls were made of ivory, and the ivory was mammoth ivory. The estimated number of mammoths through Siberia and Alaska is just absolutely mind-boggling. We're talking millions. There are many places around the world containing virtual log jams of fossilized dinosaur bones. Dinosaur National Monument in Utah contains over 300 different kinds of dinosaurs. The fossil graveyard in Agate Springs. I live 33 miles from Agate Springs, south of Agate Springs, and went up there many times, taking Christian schoolers, homeschoolers up there, and giving them the creation viewpoint for what they saw. And by the way, when you go up and you'd ask at Agate Springs, you know, well, how did this happen? They had a little videotape, and you push the little button, you'd watch this. And the bottom line is there was this earthen dam that broke loose, and this water came flooding down this valley, and these animals all ran to the little peaks trying to survive, but eventually they were captured, and they were all buried together, sediment on top, and fossilization took place. Now, for fossilization to take place, conditions have to be just right, by the way. I'll be coming back to that in a little bit. But this Agate Springs, Nebraska, you can find this on the internet if you like, over 9,000 animals in this one fossil graveyard. Very interesting animals, by the way. We're talking about rhinoceroses, camels, giant boars, and numerous other exotic animals. A large rock slab from that particular excavation, that particular graveyard, is in the American Museum of Natural History now. And you can probably find that on the internet. I haven't gone there. In Sicily, there are fossil graveyards with thousands of hippopotamuses. In the Permian beds of Texas, there's an estimated 8 billion fossilized clams. They've been fossilized with their shells closed in a 3-foot thick stratum. And if we're talking clams, you know, when a clam or a mussel dies, that mussel relaxes and it opens, and crustaceans, fish come along and they eat the clam. But these were buried alive. The clams are shut. And evolutionists tend to want to clam up on this, you know, which, anyway, the old red sandstone fossil bed of England, it has shoals of billions of fish fossilized in contorted states of agony spread over, listen, 10,000 square miles with as many as 1,000 fish in one square yard. Now, you can check this out yourself if you like. Red sandstone fossil bed of England. Mind-boggling amount of fossils. Now, in contorted states of agony, you know, these fish were buried alive. You know, were buried alive. Well, you know, if you take a fish, and I think of in Nebraska, where I used to do some fly fishing, and I would fish with a barbless hook and that. And anyway, not that I'm against catching fish and eating them. I think God gave them to us for that purpose. But I'd go in the afternoon sometime for an hour or two and fish. And often I'd take my little trout almost all the time. I'd let him go. Well, I was real careful how I handled the little trout, because the younger ones especially, they're not super hardy, at least the rainbows weren't. And there were times where I'd go back the next day and then further downstream and look down, and here's a little trout on his back and dead. And have a strong feeling this is one of the ones that I'd put back in the water the day before. But they often didn't look the same. You know, the little eyes had been kind of eaten out, or something had got a hold of him and tore in his little stomach, and his insides were kind of coming out. Would you like me to be more graphic? Okay. For some fossilization to take place, something needs to be captured quickly, where there's not a lot of oxygen present, encapsulated in sediment with water, and the composition needs to be just right for this mineral exchange to take place, for the minerals to replace the organic tissue. But anyway, so we're talking about these things buried alive. The Miocene herring bed of California has an estimated 8 billion fossilized fish that were buried alive, very similar. Billions of fossilized trilobites rolled into defensive balls found in the mountains, well above 5,000 feet. Well, trilobites are marine creatures. This last year I was in the West Indies, Antigua, West Indies. And one of the afternoons that I had free, one of the fellas took me out to go snorkeling along the reefs there, Antigua Island, about 10 by 12 miles. And I got out there, got my mask and everything ready to get in the water. And here on the rocks, as we were working our way down to the water, close to the water, here I looked at that. I said, that's a trilobite. And I took several pictures. It's a trilobite. Well, I came back and, of course, did some research on my computer. And one of the sites I looked at said, the caption was this: don't be fooled by what appear to be trilobites today. They don't want on some elaborate explanation. Well, sure looked like a trilobite to me. And I'm not a super scientist here, but, you know, to me, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, talks like a duck, yeah, it just might be a pigeon, right? Yeah.
Don't believe your eyes, John.
Don't believe your eyes. Seeing is believing. Your perception of what you're seeing is correct. Well, how are we doing on time here, Dave? 5 minutes left. Well, a little more, and then I'll come back to this next week. But in the Karoo Formation of South Africa alone, there's an estimated 800, listen to this number, billion fossils of amphibians and reptiles covering an area of some 200,000 square miles. The huge fossil beds that are found in the Gobi Desert, the Rocky Mountains, the Black Hills, and it goes on and on and on and on. And when you get into this, how did all these things get here and get fossilized? As far as I know, in every case you look into, you're going to find water, sediment. You're talking flood. You're talking, those ingredients are necessary. They need to be buried, and they need to be buried quickly. Oh, well, where are all the bison of North America? You know, we have all this fossilization on a global scale now. Well, what about fossils today? You know, relatively recently, you know, we're talking about settling the West, and unfortunately, sad to say, there were those that would ride on trains and just shoot bison just to shoot them, and not even take the pelt or the meat or anything to be used in a constructive way, just leave them lying there. And where are all those fossilized bison? You know, when something dies, we have scavengers that come along and eat, and whatever, there's decay just from oxygen from the sun, it deteriorates. And so, again, fossilization, for it to take place, it needs to be buried quickly, and the conditions need to be just right. So we're kind of like where we were with the coal, with the fossils. You know, we have all this coal all around us, but yet we don't see coal being formed at any appreciable rate today. And the same holds true for fossils. I mean, the estimate on these fossils is beyond, it's almost mathematically, beyond mathematics almost. Okay, now I realize what I said is wasn't real consistent there. But we're talking about a number that's just boggling to the human mind on a global scale. You look at what is presented with the geologic column, something called the Precambrian Void. You get to a level where the bottom layer, you don't find anything in terms of fossils. And then you have what's called the Cambrian Explosion, where you have fossils on a global scale, not on one little area on Earth and gradually evolving and migrating to different parts, but on a global scale. And that, again, supports the Bible. Well, I've talked away our program here this morning. Dave, I didn't give you a chance to say much anything.
Well, that's good. My voice is not so good today.
Well, glad you're doing better. And I want to mention, I appreciate Prescott Valley Christian Church, their support of this program. Also, the church in Palmer, Alaska. Church of Christ in Palmer, Alaska, that supports the program. That is very much appreciated. If you'd like to contact me, you can through creationscience.net. And then go to contact us, drop me an email, whether you agree or you don't agree, or you have questions, areas you like, topics you'd like me to address. I most certainly don't think I have all the answers. I most certainly don't think I have things figured out, but I very much would appreciate your feedback. Or you can write to me directly, jnay@creationscience.net. With questions, comments, and if you don't agree, that's fine. Don't be nasty about it, but if you don't agree, I'd like to hear what you do believe and your argumentation for your particular view. So thank you for being with us this morning.
You know, John, just we have another minute and a half here. You know what just kills me is that this indoctrination our kids get in schools instead of the education they're supposed to be getting from our textbooks and their teachers. These authority figures who they trust, of course, mm-hmm. as telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And when they get this mix of facts with untruth, they have it's impossible for them to separate the untruth from the factual. And so they take it all in as just all factual.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with the word indoctrination, and I just don't believe that it's intellectually honest to present the argumentation or what's in support of one view if there is an opposing view, not to allow that to be presented. You know, there's nothing wrong with the minds of our young people. Why not give them the scientific support of the evolution viewpoint, the scientific support of the creation viewpoint, and allow them to choose, allow them to weigh in the balance, if you will, of reason, which is makes the most sense. But to not do that, to only give one view exclusively, I agree with the word indoctrination. And that's why in the Soviet Union, what you learned in school, there was absolutely nothing to do with a God or a creator, because it was censored out, not only of the school, but of their culture, their society. And I'm sad to say, I think that that has definitely happened in America now.
Well, we're out of time, and we'll see you back the same time next week.
Okay.